Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming. This is Way-Seeking Mind Talk. It's a traditional talk given by Shuso about how I came to practice and how my practice has been. I'm going to be giving the talk in two parts today. Maybe a little self-indulgent, but I don't know. I just felt like I had a lot to say. So I came to Buddhist practice at a pretty early age. So there's a lot in my early life that led up to that. And then a lot of history after that. I was born in Honolulu, Hawaii in 1960, but my family lived there for only 1 year before moving back to my parents' college town of Eugene, Oregon. My father was a kind, quick-witted, and humorous man who grew up in Detroit, spent his summers at the old family place that my great-great-great-grandfather had built on an island near Canada, and had followed his older brother, my Uncle David, out west. My mother was a sharp-as-a-tack, only daughter of an Eastern Oregon sawmill foreman, and his wife, the oldest of four daughters, which formed the matriarchy of my closest family relations as I grew up. Almost weekly, during the years I was 3 or 4 years old in Eugene, my older sister would take me on a walk across campus to my father's office, and we always stopped to go through the university's Asian art exhibits at the museum. And being children who liked to repeat experiences, we always went to see the same things. There were the bronze Buddha heads, the stone-cut relief carvings of Hindu deities, the mystical Taoist priest robes, the jade carvings, the spring and autumn scrolls, and the Korean dolls. And there was the fully appointed Chinese emperor's throne room, where we always ducked the velvet ropes and sat on the thrones. I had to sit on the smaller one because I was the little brother. And there was the outdoor courtyard reflecting pool with raindrops splattering the surface where it was formal and quiet, and I always had to be told it was time to go. When I was 4, my brother was born, and soon after my father had his first heart attack and open heart surgery at age 42. From then on, we were always admonished to be careful, not stress my dad out or make loud noises, and the specter of his illness was always present. At age 5, we moved to Birch Lane in the nicer neighborhood on the wooded ridge overlooking town. Down the hill was a place I called the Magic Woods. Strange and good things always happened in the Magic Woods, and sometimes when I was there, I thought I could understand what the crows overhead were saying. Up the hill were more woods and Jeffrey Alvarado's house, where at age 5 we would make campfires and smoke cigarettes. And eventually we burned down the neighbor's woodshed. I had to have a little sit-down with the city fire marshal, and I couldn't play with Jeffrey Alvarado anymore. Now, the first time I remember anyone saying, "On your mark, get set, go," was the summer I was 5. A few days after moving to Birch Lane, my mother had taken me and my new best friend, Byrne, down to the all-comers track meet at the university, and I was running the 75-yard dash for 5- and 6-year-olds down the middle of the grass infield of Hayward Field, which was across the street from my grade school. Hayward Field has become the mecca of American track and field, and Eugene is always on the short list, including places like Helsinki, Berlin, Rome, and a few others of the world's premier track and field cities. All of this started really happening during my growing up, and mostly because of the Oregon coach, Bill Bowerman, who also was the one organizing these all-comer meets. During those years, the premier meet was the Oregon Twilight Invitational, where at the moment of sundown on a spring evening, Bowerman would try to see how many of his athletes he could put under 4 minutes in the mile. There were times I saw as many as five go under the barrier in one race. Coming out of second grade, they said I might have to repeat the grade. I got diagnosed with a condition that no one else seemed to have in those days, ADD, and the doctors wanted to put me on Ritalin. It was sort of like the Matrix, you know, take the red pill or the blue pill. Except here it was take this pill or repeat second grade. So I took the pill. But if anyone had asked, I would have told them there was nothing wrong and that the reason I didn't get my schoolwork done and was that school, and especially math, was stupid. I just couldn't make myself do those assignments, and taking the pill never really changed that, so I spent my entire school career being 25 or 30 assignments behind every semester in math and having to make it all up at the end. What made the whole thing worse was my evil third grade teacher, Miss Norwood, who believed that classroom management involved publicly paddling us on the bottom with a selection from her drawer of toy baseball bats and making everyone's business everyone else's business. And she told all the kids I was on medication for a mental condition. This resulted in years of teasing. One thing I realize now that I unconsciously did to compensate was to cultivate a wide assortment of friendships as a counteraction to the cliquishness that the teasing seemed to represent. And I found that my less popular friends teased me much less than my more popular friends. My father was a quiet and confirmed Christian, and he took us three kids to church, St. Mary's Episcopal, not with great regularity, but occasionally. I remember just about nothing about the teachings, but I remember the rhythm, down to the kneeling board to pray, back into the pew, back down to pray. I didn't know what we were meant exactly to do when praying, because no one ever gave instructions, but there was something about it that always made me wonder, because this was where we spoke to God, right? And it seemed significant that there were no instructions for this. I guess I took that as a very open-handed methodology, some sort of acknowledgement of all we couldn't pretend to know. I remember Palm Sundays, the day they would give out potted pansies, and Sunday school, which I mostly thought was a ploy to keep us children doing something else while the parents were off doing something much more interesting, which they would not tell us about. I remember many rainy Sundays with my clip-on bow tie and white shirt too tight at the collar because it had been too long since the last time it was worn and I'd grown, head feeling light, reading the Sunday comics in the car on the way home, which always made me somewhat nauseous, then the too sugary Easter basket and the syrupy pancakes, and then feeling rather ill. By 13, I got confirmed. And there was a little youth group thrown in, I'm not sure what for, and then we didn't really go anymore. My mother never went to church, being, as was the whole matriarchy of her side of the family, agnostic or atheistic. I never really knew because religion was never spoken of in our house or with my relatives. And I think this was why we stuck quite closely to this branch of the family because, for instance, Uncle David's wife was reported to be some sort of evangelical brand of faith that my mother could not abide by. One result of this was a sort of denial of death that went on throughout my life with my family because my grandmother and none of the aunties ever had funerals. Another elemental part of my growing up was the beach. Every summer, for almost a month, my family would move to the coast and stay in a cabin on the beach with no telephone, no television, My days were spent shoeless on the beach, and because of the age gap between myself and my older sister and younger brother, mostly alone. I mostly spent my time setting up the task for myself of building elaborate beach forts. When not building forts, I would scour the beach in search of the item that hovered in my imagination as the most prized of all beachcombing finds, the Japanese glass fishing float. My sense of geography was a very direct and palpable thing for me growing up. Japan was somewhere right there, over that ocean horizon. And not so far away, evidenced by the fact that although I never found one, those glass orbs did sometimes come up on those beaches. Most places seemed far away. Oregon, especially back when I was growing up, was an extremely provincial place. No place was thought to be better. Why vacation anywhere else when you live here? And those Californians, in their slow Winnebagoes creeping along the ocean cliffs, well, we should just build a wall at the border. I never traveled anywhere much out of the state until I was almost 20 and never flew in a plane except once to Seattle for 20 minutes until I was 24. We had a neighborhood kids newspaper run by our stay-at-home, overeducated moms, The Grasshopper, that ran 10 issues each spring for 10 years. The Grasshopper picnic each year was the event of the season. The older kids usually got to collectively write a feature or interview each issue, and one day my brother brought into the Grasshopper clubhouse Steve Prefontaine. Prefontaine was the now legendary Oregon runner who at one time held all six American records between 2,000 and 10,000 meters. This day at the Grasshopper, he was the precocious and fiery-eyed 19-year-old freshman phenomenon from Coos Bay who had broken the prep national two-mile mark and very nearly taken the NCAA cross-country crown that fall, battling Jerry Lindgren down to the final step. We each got autographs on a torn-off page of a yellow steno pad. I still have mine, a prized treasure, a full Steve Prefontaine. It being soon after that that the simple moniker Pre would be all he would have time to jot on the meet programs, t-shirts, and arms of the hordes of kids who flocked to him at every meet. Because even then, the stands of Hayward Field had begun to boil with a thunderous signature stamping, a rhythmic confluence of athlete and spectator beyond what anyone had heard before that echoed, "Go, Pre, go, Pre, go, Pre." Even to this day, in Eugene, the story goes, and I witnessed it many times myself, so I say it's true, that at a meet, the clouds would always part when Pre stepped on the Hayward Field track. As I got a little older, my running abilities began to show themselves. In junior high, I was winning races and setting school records. Now, you can't know too much about me until you know a little something about Roosevelt Junior High School and the Roosevelt Rough Riders. A couple years before I got to Roosevelt, there had been a student revolution, sit-down strike, grievances, and a new curriculum which involved no requirements and no grades. The annual theater production the year before I entered school was a full-stage production of the rock opera Tommy. This was 1971. The album had just come out the previous year, with eighth graders with electric guitars slashing away, the Acid Queen, Evil Uncle Ernie. Our cheerleaders wore tie-dyed overalls. At any time of the school day, you could go out the back door and wade through the tall grass of the field behind the school and find a circle of 6 or 12 students smoking pot. One time, I can't remember what class this was for, a self-made assignment. I spent an entire day inside of a cardboard box. I think the idea was something about sensory deprivation. But there were moments in the dark when I lost complete track of time, and I was surprised when someone came to get me at the end of the day because I thought it was too soon. But many parts of the education were excellent. An inquiry was encouraged. The music and theater departments of the school were top-notch. I took music history courses there that were better than similar courses I took years later in college. And by age 13, encouraged by my music teacher, I tried out for and became the youngest member of the Eugene Junior Symphony for people up to 21. The summer of 72, just before entering Roosevelt, Eugene hosted the U.S. Track and Field Olympic Trials. This was a 10-day meet modeled on the Olympic schedule that would select the team to go to Munich. It was the first in a series, including 76 and 80, that Eugene hosted this event, the biggest meet in the U.S. every 4 years, right through my teens. And this in a town which at the time was the size of Bellingham. At Munich, on the day after the terrorist attacks, which held us all transfixed to the television, Priest stepped to the line. At 21 years old, the youngest man ever to make the Olympic 5000 final. In the final last mile that's still remembered as one of the most exciting in Olympic history, Priest drove to the lead, only to be repeatedly cut off and then nipped at the line to miss the bronze. Now, Priest was acting as a mentor at the junior high, and we would see him running usually up and down the halls from one thing to another. Here I'll mention a few friends I began to make during this part of my life, all runners too. There was a grade behind me, perhaps my closest friend, Jeff, who consistently would break any record or mark I had set from the year before. A grade ahead of me was Jim, my closest training partner in high school, and like me, having the intention to enter architecture school in college. Also a year ahead was Paul, who we all called PT, dashingly good-looking and unafraid to approach females, and therefore our chosen front man for our summertime raids on the motel swimming pools to chat up out-of-town girls. PT dated Jeff's sister at the senior prom. PT, Jeff, and a couple others and I formed a sort of band of brothers, getting into all sorts of trouble. We were not good boys. There was shoplifting, hucking, throwing things at cars, jockey boxing, rifling through glove boxes of cars, and D&D, dine and dash. There was drinking and smoking weed in the woods at the football games. There was hanging out down on the gut, where the muscle cars cruised. There was diving from 40-foot tall railroad trestles into the river, and there was going down to the train yards at night and hopping freights and taking little trips across the yards. At our nearest rival junior high, Spencer Butte, these were the two junior highs that were the feeders to the high school, there was, in my same grade, Scott, the crosstown rival I could never beat, who shared the same birthday with me. Scott and I became close friends and co-team captains in high school. And also at Spencer Butte was, one year ahead of me, Billy. The story goes that one day in health class at Spencer Butte, Pre was showing the kids how to gauge their fitness by taking their resting pulse rate. Pre came up with 42, and Billy had 40. Billy was the most talented of four brothers, multiple state champions, and the most recruited track athlete in the nation his senior year. There's a quote from Pree that Billy especially liked, and it applies equally to Billy, really. Pree said once, "Some people create with words or with music or with a brush and paints. I like to make something beautiful when I run. I like to make people stop and say, I've never seen anyone run like that before. It's more than just a race. It's a style. It's doing something better than anyone else. It's being creative. A race is a work of art that people can look at and be affected by in as many ways as they're capable of understanding." Roosevelt shared our track with the high school, South Eugene. As we progressed in junior high, it became available for some of us to train with the high school during our off season. The story goes that one day myself, Jeff, and Jeff's closest training partner, Pat, went over to introduce ourselves to the South coach, Harry Johnson, who we had never met. the meeting had been prearranged, and so I simply said, "Hi, Coach Johnson, we're the boys from Roosevelt." And Harry said, "We only have men on this team." Which was really the perfect thing to say, and it won us over immediately, because at Roosevelt, for 2 years running, the annual school play production had been a modernized adaptation of Taming of the Shrew entitled Ms. And calling any 14-year-old female at my school a girl got you an immediate lecture. But no one had ever called us men. But that was the situation working with Harry. The South Eugene High School program in the 70s was the best track and field program in the nation, and maybe the best that's ever been. Our work was pretty well laid out for us. There were twice-a-day workouts. And every day in high school, for first period, I had a class called co-ed running that was simply a way for me to do my morning workout. Through the years in high school, there were individual national high school records by various friends of mine, an amazing string of state championships that lasted over 12 years, and South set a series of national high school records in relay events. I was able to be part of one of those, running the half-mile leg of a distance medley relay in my junior year and handing off to Billy for the mile anchor leg. Coming into the exchange zone and dying, I had barely enough left to get the baton off to him. There was a moment, the whites of Billy's eyes glancing back. I couldn't reach far enough, and I had to dive forward into what ended up as a tumble onto the track, tunnel focused on just his hand. That record lasted almost a decade. But 35 years later, most of those other national records have still never been broken. Jeff's national high school steeplechase record set in 79 is so good, it seems as though it may never be broken. We never lacked for self-confidence. It was really a time when a kid could dream that maybe he too could be an Olympian. But in the midst of it all, at the end of my ninth grade year, came the day that Pree died in a car accident just in front of the Alvarado's house. A few days later, 7,000 of us filed into the old wooden East grandstands where just a few days ago we had watched Pree run his final race. In the final mile, he'd moved away from everyone. No one could stay with him. Even Frank Shorter, the winner of the Munich Marathon, who had got second that day, said afterwards, "By that point, he was just beyond me." And you'll know that it is that race if you see a picture of Pree, because it is the only race in his life that he ever wore a black singlet. We filed into the East grandstands, and the stadium clock was started and set to stop at what some felt would have been for Pree a satisfactory world record time for 3 miles. As the clock ran, first Bowerman, then Shorter, and finally Kenny Moore, who besides having gotten fourth in the Munich Marathon, was also a world-class sports writer, spoke. Moore said, "He conceived of his sport as a service, in the way an artist serves. Without that, he would never have given us all the records. They were out beyond winning or losing, which a runner does for himself. They came from those furious minutes near the end of a race when his relentlessness and our excitement blended into a joyous thunder." All of us who now say I had no idea how much this man meant to me do so because we didn't realize how much we meant to him. He was our glory and we his. Then he stepped away from the podium, and then stepped back and said, "There are 2 minutes on the clock. He could run a half mile." Then we all waited in silence, 7,000 people for a minute and a half. Nothing had been indicated about how this would finish other than the clock running out. But with 30 seconds to go, I, like everyone else, looked over at the 200 meters to go mark. And as the imaginary runner was coming around the bend, a truly amazing display of public ceremony spontaneously unfolded. As first from the left and then traveling all down the grandstand, the crowd applauded in a rolling wave that finally trickled out at the finish line and was over. The clock stopped, and silence swept back to fill the space. Now the rock outcropping a couple blocks distance above the house I grew up in where Pree's MG turned over, has become a devotional site. At any time, and especially when a major meet is in town, the rock is festooned with offerings, meat ribbons, someone's race numbers from Boston, state championship medals, shoes, t-shirts. Runners and athletes from all over the world leave items of significance at this spot to remember this person who inspired so many. That summer, after my ninth grade year, my family bought a beach cabin on the beach where we had always vacationed. Now, instead of renting, we would have our own place to go to whenever we wanted. My father hired a carpenter, and I came to work, too, for 75 cents an hour, from which I had to pay for my own groceries and laundry. I suppose the wage was that low to help my family save money, but also to instill a sense of frugality in me. The carpenter was John Pound, a 40-something hippie artist from California whose work vehicle was a VW van with an American flag draped along the whole ceiling inside. Think Jimmy Buffett plus 40 pounds in overalls with a pipe clenched in the corner of his mouth and a wry little Santa Claus twinkle in his eye. John was a self-taught remodeler, experienced in a lot of things, willing to try something he hadn't really done before. He also was an astute observer of the human condition, born from his years in therapy, a very Californian attribute, and something which I regarded with much respect. And he was extremely accepting of me and fond of me, and was the only person in my life who has ever, with any sense of acceptance from me, been able to call me Bobby. Living alone on the coast had its difficulties and loneliness. I was 15 years old, living alone with a bicycle to get around. I had no telephone or TV, only the radio at night to keep me company. And the wide-stretched Oregon beaches are not the sort of place to go and meet people. It's the kind of place people go to be alone. But although it was difficult at times, I also liked it. And I went back and worked with John again the following summer, too. In high school, Jeff and I had started getting into bow hunting. I had always done archery since childhood, taught by my mother, who had been taught by my grandfather. I had always been inspired by my grandfather, who had died when I was 11, a man with a quiet and deeply assured bearing, a hunter and fisherman, who had tended a half-acre garden at his place on the banks of the Rogue River, where he pulled steelhead out from his walking dock, and where he would wash newly pulled carrots for me from the irrigation ditch beside the grape arbors and raspberries. Now, Jeff and I were exploring hunting as a way to be responsible for what we ate, and I suppose to find out if killing was really something we could do. We built our own bows and arrows, learned blood tracking, how to hand sharpen our broadheads so they could shave the hair on our arms, practiced field shooting in odd positions, studying how to skin a deer, and took hunter safety courses. On weekend trips, we'd drive high into the dark coast range on early foggy mornings before dawn and stalk through the woods in camouflage clothing covered with deer musk scent, moving as quietly as possible and listening. At other times, we would travel over the mountains together with Pat to camp in the junipers and stalk through the hard frost sagebrush hunting jackrabbits, which, with a bow, it's no wonder we never got any, but we did get shots. We never managed to take a shot at the deer, though. I did have one encounter in the deeply twilit woods, a silhouette that looked like it had antlers, my hand trembling on the string, the darkness growing, and inside, a jackhammer heart pounding, my legs quivering, sweat immediately beating up, and almost feeling like I couldn't breathe. After this, I decided that I probably would not want to go through with the whole killing thing, and when I went to college, I became a vegetarian, which was for me really an extension of the same thought about food. I was reading Thoreau and Muir and Emerson in high school. And something I did each year during high school, sometime in the spring, was to pick a weekend and ride my bike out to Mount Pisgah, the new 2,000-acre hiking park on the edge of town, and camp out alone for the night. On these trips, I would go back into the woods and find deer. I would try to get as close as possible and feel the deer's presence and become part of its world. I had an almost mystical feeling about deer back then. And when something like this was able to happen, it felt very special. That summer before my senior year, a few blocks away, my dad's best friend from college, Ed Frazier, an editorial page columnist for the Eugene Register Guard, got up after dinner, went into the bathroom, took out a pistol and shot himself in the head. He didn't leave a note. I can only imagine what my father's feelings were. It wasn't as though we had the kind of relationship where he would come lean on me, but one day, a couple weeks after it happened, he just turned to me with this pained look and simply said, "Why would anyone do that?" And I knew what he was referring to. Then at some point that fall, he had another heart attack. He was in the hospital for a while, then some rest, then back to work in a limited way. It was scary, but I guess filtering through the denial, I believed he was going to get through this all right. Along with this came other new pressures my senior year of high school. The summer before, Harry had signed papers with Bowerman to move to Nike and be the coach for their new corporate team. This was not completely unexpected, as we had a very close relationship with this new upstart little local shoe company testing Bowerman's prototype models, and we were the first team of any kind in the country to be completely outfitted with a set of Nike shoes. But it put a lot of pressure on Scott and myself to help usher in our new coach. Harry's hand-picked successor and a former South athlete, John Gillespie, into our way of doing things. The emphasis upon continuity was extremely important, and so much so that continuing to this day, a former Harry Johnson athlete has coached the South Eugene team, and currently that is Jeff. Additionally, Scott helped rally my awareness about a new decision made by Jimmy Carter to require under penalty of law that all 18-year-old males register for the draft. This was the first ever peacetime draft registration in the history of the country, and it continues to this day. So we went down to the local peace organization and got counseling for conscientious objector status and began participating in anti-draft registration protests. So these many strands of questions dealing with life and death, deep moral choices, and responsibility were coalescing around my senior year. Then on New Year's Eve day, coming back from a snow camping trip, Jeff and I spontaneously decided to try to climb a huge cliff we saw. We got only so far. Then I kicked loose a 300-pound boulder and went careening 20 yards down the slope with it, the boulder and I. It rolled over my leg twice, then was coming for my head. I got my hands on it and finally pushed myself free. My right calf was crushed, but the bone wasn't broken. I was 6 weeks on crutches, each day to the pool to swim and keep fitness, then 2 weeks walking, 2 weeks jogging, and finally actual running. Then, while helping with field events at one of our first meets, a discus skipped wrong and hit me right in the calf and sent me back another couple weeks. My senior year in track, by the standard of which I was hoping to prove myself to whatever college might, by some wild luck, want to recruit me, was hanging by a thread. And my father was back at home, growing sicker and weaker. I made it to the district meet. Only the top two qualified for state. By the top of the final turn, I'd forged up to the shoulder of the early leader, but then two more came up, and for a moment we were four abreast, and that was it. There wasn't any more I could give. The three drifted away, and I hit the line a second behind. But at this point, it didn't really matter. I felt at least I was running. Someone was waving to me beside the track. It was my father in his wheelchair. He had insisted that my sister bring him to the meet. I had no idea he would be there, and I believe it may have been the last time that he made it out of the house. He waved me over and told me how proud he was of me. It really touched me because I didn't even realize he knew that I was there that day and what the race meant. Not long after that, the call came down the stairs in the middle of the night, and the family flew into action like some kind of drill team. I was given the keys, and driving maybe 90 miles an hour, I made it to the hospital in just about 3 minutes. Caught up with adrenaline, I simply followed my father on the gurney into the back room while the rest of the family collapsed in the waiting room. In the back room, they had him on a machine that went beep, beep. He was talking with me softly for a bit, then closed his eyes for a minute. And then the beep, beep sound stopped. I touched his shoulder. He opened his eyes again. The beeping started back, and he said, "What?" And I said, "Nothing. It's okay." He was in intensive care for a couple days, and then at one moment they wheeled him out into a regular room. I knew that this meant that they had decided that there was nothing more to do. I found a minute and slipped into the room so I could see him alone. He told me that there was not much else to do at this point. Feeling desperate, feeling like there had to be something I could say that would change the situation, I said, "Dad, I've seen a lot of guys give up. Isn't there more you can do?" And he said, "Bob, there's a time when you have to let go." A day or so later, the priest was called in for the last rites. We were basically living on the couches in the waiting area down the hall. I hadn't been home or barely eaten anything for days. I stood at the foot of the bed watching as the priest gave the last rites. My father was on his side, and when the priest began the Lord's Prayer, my father's hands moved together in front of his face in prayer position, and I could see his lips mouthing the words in unison. These were the last words that I ever saw him speak. Right there, I made a very clear decision, born from seeing the clear faith that my father had. I decided that I would seek out as far as I could what life and death was for me in my life, and that I would start now. A week after my father passed away, we had the state meet. I'd not qualified, but the mile relay was an option. There was another boy, and Gillespie ran us through separate time trials, and we came up with exactly the same time. And Gillespie said, "I'm going to choose the other boy, because after all you've lost, I don't want you to risk losing anything more." It came down to the last event, the mile relay. South and another team were tied in the score. If we won the mile relay, we would win the meet. If they won the mile relay, they would win the meet. Watching while standing up in the back of a dump truck of sand for the pits, I had a clear view of the finish line. They won by just a stride. It was the only time over a 13-year stretch that my high school would lose the state meet. It took me a long time, probably a couple decades, to be thankful that he hadn't put me in that race. For a long time, I always thought about it like, I could have beaten that guy. But actually, I see now that it could have just as easily ended up the same way. And it's true that that is certainly not what I would have liked to have been living with all these years as the final coda to that year. There was no work available, but I went to the coast anyway and told John Pound about my father, and he was like the only person in my life who seemed to be able to talk to me like a peer. We talked late into the night and walked out on the beach. He told me all about my father because he'd worked with him closely on remodeling our cabin. He also told me about his own father's death, how he had been the one to find him, the bedspread torn back, the lamp pushed over, the angina pills sprayed across the bed. He called it Dad's last scene, He was someone who was really there for me, and I felt like he could relate. And although I never spent another full summer working with John as I had in high school, on rare occasions I would drop by whenever I had the chance to stay in touch. I went to Oregon that fall and was running on the team, living with other guys on the team, in house off campus, living with Billy and his older brother Steve and a couple others. We had a few wild parties, but mostly we just trained hard. Things were difficult for me with the Oregon coach, and I was convinced that in 4 months' time, he had never learned my name. I now realize that he was very depressed for many years after Pree's death, and it showed in how he related to us. Billy's brother Steve, who had been a mentor to many of us younger runners, wasn't doing well, was experiencing some sort of strange problem where his lower legs would fall asleep in the middle of races. One day, up at the family house in the South Hills, he slit his wrists and then called Billy, who got there just in time to get him to the hospital. Shortly after that, the house disbanded. One roommate was especially difficult to deal with. I was in architecture school, a demanding program, and at about that time, a shift in class schedules precluded me from being able to attend workouts, and I dropped off the team. I went to living in a household of people, mostly not students and older than me, who lived far from campus. One of my roommates was a guy, also named Steve, a reclusive pothead who just stayed in his room all the time. He went away for 2 weeks for Christmas, and when he came back, when he walked in the door, it was the most radical transformation I've ever seen in a person before or since. Steve was clean-shaven, bright-eyed, well-dressed, and he had had a religious conversion. He had become born again. On the airplane headed out to Tennessee, he'd seen all the people with him on the plane as souls, and he had thrown away his drugs and had what seemed to be a very heartfelt conversion. One day I was standing in the doorway of his room talking with him, and I glanced at his Bible sitting there, and he said, "Are you interested in taking a look at that?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "You know, why don't you just have it? It's yours." And he gave me his Bible. And I thought, you know, that's a sign. I'm going to read this from front to back. Just about that time, I was in a wide-ranging lecture course in architecture school, and there was this Chinese structures professor tossing slides quickly up, and he threw up one with a bunch of crazy diagrams and symbols on it and said, "Oh, that's from the I Ching. It's the pattern of the universe." And then he switched slides. And I said to myself, "The what?" And that very night, at almost 10 o'clock, I was walking home and stopped into a bookstore and was just perusing books in the philosophy section as I used to do, and there was this book, The I Ching. And I said, "You know, I'm going to buy that." So I was reading the Bible and The I Ching. And after a while, I began to see that the Bible was sort of a mishmash. But when I would come to these parts where Jesus spoke, I would feel like, hey, this guy's got something going on. And I began feeling this sort of soft, warm, in-touch feeling about Jesus and wondering to myself if I should take this farther. One day I was walking home again. I met a very young guy, maybe even a year or two younger than me, and somewhat disheveled and standing on the street corner and preaching the Lord's word. I engaged him in conversation, feeling like I wanted to be open to people. And he said to me, "Let's go back to my place nearby and testify to God." And I said, "Okay." And we went back to his little hovel of a place and got down on the floor amidst his junk and dirty laundry and with our hands on the Bible. And he said, "Do you take Jesus into your heart?" And I said, feeling like, okay, this is the moment. If I can't do it here, where could I do it? And I said, "It's just not there. Sorry." And I left. I was taking Asian art classes, Chinese art, Indian art, and at one point, of course, they dutifully need to tell you a little bit about the religion that all this art you're looking at is from. So there was a quick rendition of the Four Noble Truths. And I remember when jotting this down in my class notes thinking, no way. But sometime that year, I overheard a conversation. I overheard just this one piece of the conversation while standing waiting for coffee on the second floor of the architecture school. I heard someone say, have you ever heard Alan Watts speak? He has a very mesmerizing voice. And that was all I heard. And months later, in the summertime, with my friend Matt, another runner from high school, hanging out, unemployed, in the current economic downturn, bored, Matt said, what should we do? And I said, you know, let's go to the university listening library. I heard that there's this guy, Alan Watts, and he has a really mesmerizing voice. So, not knowing anything else, up for an adventure, we went to the listening library. And they gave you this little cassette recorder with two sets of earphones to plug into one recorder, and we would sit down across from each other. And they had a set of tapes, The Essential Alan Watts. We thought, that must be pretty good. There were 10 tapes, and we came back every day and listened to the two tapes for 5 days straight, 10 hours of Alan Watts lectures, just sitting across from each other, with these little glimmers of recognition flashing in our eyes as we were listening to this, just going, yeah. The listening library was just in a room that you got to by ditching down between the stacks at one point on the second floor. And it was in this row of stacks that we passed down every day where all the age and religion books were. So that summer I read Three Pillars of Zen, Zen Keys, Selling Water by the River, and a whole slew of Buddhist books. And of course I read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which was the book which impressed me the most. And even if today, if you ask me, there's really only one line I remember that stuck with me the most from that book. After the introductory chapter, the fun simile about expert mind and beginner's mind, then the book starts proper. There's a warm-up paragraph into the topic of posture, and then the second paragraph starts and says, after some years, we will die. If we think that this is the end of our life, this will be the wrong understanding. But, on the other hand, if we think that we do not die, that is also wrong. We die, and we do not die. That is the right understanding. And I thought, I'd never heard anything so clear in my life. So, my initial foray into meditation was that summer, in my bedroom, with various too soft cushions piled up. I had crossed my legs, got plumb and straight, tried to do whatever it was I thought I was supposed to do with my attention and breathing. And within only 30 seconds or so, I began to get this feeling, and I thought, I think I'm getting enlightened. And then everything got foggy. I was doing it all wrong and actually hyperventilating, and then I hit the floor. Eventually, I got better at it. But for a number of years, it was something I would only do when I had the time, but not consistently, as my real focus was very much still on running, sort of what I call my first monkhood before Buddhism. Well, thank you. We'll pick this up again in the afternoon. May our intentions equally penetrate.